I think there's a lot of head fakes in B2B marketplaces, honestly. Like, maybe this is a hot take, but they're not always my favorite category for the very reason that you can get like a founder that is maybe the best salesperson in a category that is like, hey, I'm going to do a marketplace. And realistically, what they're doing is like their force of personality makes them a great broker, and they just run it through the marketplace. And really what you're getting are these tech-enabled brokerages. You're not really getting a marketplace model. They look like a marketplace, but they're not actually a marketplace. And so you can get to the Series A and B level revenue.
Yeah.
And then they actually can't cross the chasm into real self-service marketplaces.
Welcome to Two-Sided, the Marketplace Podcast, brought to you by ShareTribe.
Hello and welcome. I am Stuart, CMO at ShareTribe, and I am your host. This is episode number 6 of this season, and today we're talking to Colin Gardiner, a former marketplace operator turned investor who shares his insight on what it takes to build a successful marketplace. Having worked at several marketplaces or two-sided platforms, so you'll hear the ones that we discuss. Probably the most famous one of that is Outdoorsy, the RV rental marketplace, where Colin first worked as chief product officer and eventually as the chief revenue officer. We all know how well Outdoorsy is doing nowadays, so it's a pretty interesting experience. But generally, Colin has a vast experience on which we can draw. And in recent years, he also has added investing to that experience. So we use all that to basically discuss strategies that Colin thinks could lead to growth for market. He also opens up about what he looks for in early stage marketplace businesses as an investor and how founders can set themselves up for success from day one. Key highlights from this episode, in my opinion, we discussed the critical importance of having unique supply and demand aggregation for successful marketplaces. We also talk a little bit of history, the shift from, you know, marketplace 1.0 to verticalized platforms and how these tailored solutions are taking over the horizontal models. And finally, why having a sharp go-to-market strategy and distribution plan is just as vital to success as having the right product. A terrific episode, a really enjoyable conversation. And if you're an aspiring marketplace founder, I think this episode again offers valuable insights on how to stand out, how to attract the right users, and also how to scale effectively. Please enjoy my conversation with Colin Gardiner. Hi, Colin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, fantastic. You could make the time. I know you're a student of marketplaces, so I'm really excited that you agreed to come on. Before we dive in, you know, before we start unlocking the key to building a successful marketplace, I think always good to put a little bit of context. So could you tell the listeners a bit about what you did before you became a marketplace investor?
Yeah, I'd love to. The days before being an investor, I actually was an operator. I did real work. I mean, I think investors do some real work, at least sending a lot of emails. I've done a lot of that since becoming an investor. But before that, I was a longtime operator. The past 15 years, been getting the pleasure of building marketplaces. Most immediately, about almost 3 years ago now, I was left Outdoorsy, where I was a chief product officer and ultimately chief revenue officer from there. I was there for about 5 years, and we took that. And now it's done. I think they just reported $3 billion in GMV. So, you know, done a lot of RV rentals, put a lot of RVs on the road throughout the world. So really proud of my time there and everything we got to build. But before that, worked at a number of different marketplaces, including Tripping.com, Ancestry.com, Just Answer, and really fell in love with the whole idea of marketplaces and bringing, you know, commerce online. And I think that's what I love about it, and try to spend as much time focusing on those things as I possibly can.
Yeah. What is it that you, what, just question, because like, you know, you said Just Answer and Ancestry.com, and those are not like on the look a bit like, oh, they're a marketplace, but of course they are. Did you realize like already soon, maybe after the first one, because I think this is something that I see with like two-sided platform operators, to name it as broadly as possible, that people start seeing those everywhere and they're like, oh, this is my jam.
Yeah, I think it was inadvertent. And if I go back further, like when I graduated from college, I had a major in economics and a minor in math. I got my first job working at the Federal Reserve, working for Janet Yellen in San Francisco, who now runs the Treasury and originally the Federal Reserve. And my job was reporting on the U.S. labor market. And so what is one of the largest marketplaces in the world, the U.S. labor market.
Yeah.
And so that was what I cut my teeth doing, was doing analysis of the U.S. labor market. And ultimately, I was focused on a really good segment, recent college graduates, right at the, what, in 2008, right at the bottom of the Great Recession.
Oh, my God.
So I was studying why my friends couldn't get a job.
Yeah.
But that was where I cut my teeth in marketplaces. And then my first role, I decided not to go get my PhD in economics from Cal. I just deferred that and went to work at Just Answer, which was a horizontal marketplace where you could ask a doctor, a lawyer, a vet. You can do confession. You could do all of it.
Yeah.
I had everything. And I really loved that. Like, I loved the idea that, like, you could match supply and demand across any query on the internet, basically. Yeah. That was, like, a really cool concept for me.
Yeah.
So from there, I went to Ancestry. I had a number of friends that worked there and were like, you should come over here and run some product teams. And so that's what I did. And I learned, you know, at first I thought it was just a family tree.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it is a marketplace connecting people and data. And it's, you know, the underlying piece of all of it is, like, census data, you know, on all kinds of, you know, like, different records and connecting people. And the family tree is just the matching service, right? That's the output. I started to really appreciate and understand and look for these marketplace slash network effect businesses, and ultimately started leaning really heavily into them because I had a lot of experience in them and just kept doing them.
Yeah, that's cool. And it's funny because, like, when I think about, when you talk about now, like, justanswer.com, like, you know, that idea, people are still pitching that idea, right? Like in some form or another, not like necessarily that, but just that, like, ask anyone a question. I mean, like, you know, I'm thinking like, what was...
Still exists.
Yeah, exactly. And there was recently another, like, a new one where you could book a call with, like, pretty high profile people, where I was like, okay, isn't this, like, didn't we try this a couple of times already? Like Clarity, like with Dan Martell back in the day. And it's like, so, like, yeah, but, you know, it is still apparently an unsolved problem because there isn't, I mean, I wouldn't know the number one go to. I think Quora helped it for a little bit, maybe.
I think one of the interesting parables that I learned that's really relevant to marketplace founders and really the evolution of marketplace in general is that, you know, I think Just Answer was closer to the cusp of, like, the marketplace 1.0 era, where it was sufficient to just bring things online. So basically, you know, you think eBay, Amazon, you know, kind of world, it was just sufficient to bring, in Amazon's case, commerce, you know, like,
yeah,
buying CPG products online.
Yeah.
And then for eBay, it was like just resale items, right? And Just Answer, I think, was the same thing. It was a horizontal marketplace for just services. And what happens always in this, like, 2.0 era within these is that basically, you know, marketplaces come in and verticalize. They get really good at a specific vertical. And so I think, you know, people are pitching you on the same idea, but what they're really doing is they're pitching you on specific verticals. So, like, you know, the legal space, you know, you have LegalZoom, Avvo, a bunch of different ones come in. You have it like ZocDoc.
Yeah.
A bunch of different ones in the medical space. So on, you know, Intro, you know, really what they do is they allow you to talk to executives, you know, business executives.
Yeah.
So I think what you're seeing is just this verticalization of these horizontal marketplaces.
Yeah.
With better products.
Yeah.
That are more tailored.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my take on it.
No, I can see that. It's like, you know, in my mind, I'm projecting this, like, famous, you know, Craigslist unbundling kind of theory, where it's like, okay, this is what exists, and now we're all going to see these categories develop as individuals. So that makes a lot of sense. That's a good, that's a really good context for that. Thanks. You seem to have many side hustles and projects, fingers in many, what is that? Is that an expression? Like, fingers in Dutch, it's fingers in many porridges. But anyway, you have tentacles all
not
around.
Not quite the same in English.
Yeah, that's not, that did not work. Nevertheless, you do many things, but of course, what you're here to talk about mostly, or why the role in which I would love to talk to you about, is a little bit about Yonder, our current fund. Could you tell us a little bit about, like, you know, if you'd pitch Yonder to a marketplace founder who is looking also at others, like, what is the thing that sets Yonder apart? And also maybe what is the thesis that you've sold to your partners?
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to both talk about it from the founder perspective and the LP perspective.
Yeah.
Yonder is a early stage venture fund focused on, like, really first check and pre-seed investments in marketplaces. I really like to target first revenue companies. And the insight there is that marketplaces reach product market fit when they match supply and demand. And so that's really where I like to target, you know, investing in companies and coming in really early, is right when you started the process of matching supply and demand and getting it repeatable.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting time to be underwriting and investing in marketplaces. And it's something I specialize in. And I think my pitch to founders in a lot of ways is, you know, I've done this a bunch. I've done 0 to 1 in marketplaces a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I love it. I try to be fairly altruistic with my time of helping people and putting content out there. And really what I love is just helping people build them. And so that's, I think, what you get from me is someone that comes in and it's going to really help you build your marketplace, but also is going to really help you get those investors for the next round. because my network, I think, is really strong when it comes to marketplace investors. See, I know most of them and could make intros. And so I think that's what I really try to focus on is investing really early in these companies to help them build and create like a really, you know, investable marketplace, and then help them go to market, whether it's like pre-seed or seed for fundraising. And then from an LP perspective, you know, really what I'm giving people and, you know, trying to go after is like, look, I have, I think, an edge in investing early in marketplaces, which are this asset class that have just unreal returns when they hit. You know, I look at the Airbnbs, Ubers of the world, and it's like, wow, if we could index on just that business model and hit those returns are incredible. And so that's really what I'm after with people is these truly generationally defining venture outcomes. And I think a lot of them, and I know a lot of them, are, you know, network effect / marketplace businesses. And so that's what I'm investing in. And that's what I'm going after. And I'm trying to get as much like as early of exposure in those as possible to get as much, you know, ownership as possible.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's also something, it's really strange because I'm focusing mostly, you know, with ShareTribe, we focus a lot like early stage. So I'm like, you know, just getting, well, basically what same lane that you're in, like getting people from zero to one, right? Like getting an idea out there and getting it somewhere. And you sort of forget that, like, I was talking in an earlier episode that like some of the biggest IPOs the last 10 years are marketplaces, or actually like an outsized amount of them are marketplaces, and not much less than SaaS businesses or what most people often talk about as big hitters. So yeah, that is incredible. You mentioned that you like to come in when the first supply and demand gets matched. Do you have any like preference for a particular type of marketplace, particular market, you know, B2B, P2P, anything?
Yeah, I don't try to presuppose what's going to be great. I think for me, I'm industry agnostic. I'm really more business model specific. You know, really what I'm looking for, and I try to be really honest with founders when it comes to the fund, I think angel investing is a totally different answer here. But for the fund, like I have to chase things that are going to be massive outcomes. Like that's the only way the portfolio model will work, right? And so when people ask me, what do I focus on? I focus on things that can be create entirely new economies. Like when you look at Airbnb and Uber, like they have created entirely new business models and economies. And I think that for me is like, if you don't have that with your business, it's hard to pick that as something to invest in. And so that's really what I'm like after with the fund is like, what are these kind of game-changing shifts and identifying them as early as possible?
Yeah, if we draw in your angel investing experience also, then I have a sort of similar question that like, if we keep this sort of potential future scale out of the picture, but you assess an idea, like, and how do you determine like, okay, this could be something, right? Like whether it's 100 million business or 1 billion business, I think let's leave that out, but more like, okay, there, how do you evaluate something and how do you sort of determine that, okay, they're onto something?
Yeah, I think they're really basics in marketplaces that tend to do well is that if you can aggregate some set of very unique supply that other people otherwise couldn't, and there's already demand out there seeking it, those are usually the recipe for success. Marketplaces don't do super well where there isn't already a demand pull for what you're offering. Like you're usually better off identifying, hey, there's a lot of demand for X, Y, or Z thing. How do we fit the supply to it? And getting unique supply that's defensible. And so I think that's what I look for in a lot of this is like, do you have something that people really want and can't get today in some shape or form, or they're doing something to get it approximately that isn't very satisfactory? Because I see a lot of marketplaces come on and they're like, hey, we aggregated X, Y, or Z thing that's like almost like for like commodity, or it's already aggregated, or it's kind of homogenous. And those just don't have super strong like pulls from the market if they're already somewhat available.
Okay.
Right. And so maybe you can make a good business out of those. I don't think it'll reach huge scale. I know you didn't ask me to opine on scale.
No, that's cool, yeah.
But those are the things that I kind of look for. And I think you would probably agree if you reflected on the businesses you're saying are being successful. They've been able to aggregate somewhat unique supply into a demand space that's like pretty big. Take Outdoorsy, for example. There's like millions of searches a month for RV rentals, right? And we could just see that from the data. It was there, right?
Yeah.
Like, as soon as you went on Google and looked at like keyword for RV rental, you're like, oh, there's a lot of people who want to rent RVs.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out before Outdoorsy, you could just go to Cruise America, which is like not the greatest RV rental experience.
No.
Right. And so it was like, wow, basically if we bring RV rentals online, peer-to-peer RV rental, like people are going to do this.
Yeah.
That was it was that easy in a lot of ways. You didn't have to convince people that this was something they wanted to do. They just wanted the rental, right?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. When you say like, if it's there already, like I see a lot of other investors, for example, very excited about like B2B, where basically you have the transaction often already happening and the marketplace is just providing a sort of better version of the interface, you know, like a better version of the connection. What would you say if I say that? Like, I don't know if I have a full question, but I'm just like, oh, I see some friction there. Yeah.
I think the same thing still applies, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're not aggregating really unique supply for the demand, then like you're just competing with everybody else, brokers and agents and whatever. I think there's a lot of head fakes in B2B marketplaces, honestly. Like maybe this is a hot take, but they're not always my favorite category. For the very reason that you can get like a founder that is maybe the best salesperson in a category that is like, hey, I'm going to do a marketplace. And realistically, what they're doing is like their force of personality makes them a great broker and they just run it through the marketplace. And really what you're getting are these tech-enabled brokerages. You're not really getting a marketplace model. And I think that to me is a bit of a head fake in terms of like what they actually are. They look like a marketplace, but they're not actually a marketplace. And so you can get to the Series A and B level revenue.
Yeah.
And then they actually can't cross the chasm into real self-service marketplaces.
Yeah.
Because if you think about the value prop of a marketplace, it is I've reduced coordination costs such that it is easier for me to transact. If your marketplace is not necessarily, that's not the value prop of it, other than, you know, like, you know, unique supply as well, you kind of aren't taking advantage or leveraging what the beauty of like technology has done, right? And having things online. And so, I don't know, B2B marketplaces I love.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of them I've invested in that I think are great.
Yeah.
But I still view it through the same lens of like, are you bringing something online that people couldn't otherwise access?
No, I see that. Maybe I was taking it a little bit too extreme version of what you were saying, but like, I see what you mean. Like, there are B2B marketplaces that take, you know, fully fragmented, mostly offline supply side and, you know, nicely cut and organized in a way that suddenly you can browse them all at the same time and you don't need to send out like five different faxes or something like to get a reply a week later. Have you invested in any like pre-revenue? I mean, I know that you said you like to come in at revenue, but like sometimes you see an idea, it's like, okay, I'm, you know, I'm in. Like if that's the case, like what is something that would like flip the light green for you?
Yeah, I want to admit it, but yes, I really try. Like I'm 99% of the time, you know, is post-revenue. In cases where pre-revenue makes sense is usually in a B2B context where maybe the supply side, the suppliers are really big companies or really, you know, where they move slower or something like that, where there's like some hurdle time frame that has to be cleared. That's a unique case. I think the other use case that I've had is a repeat founder that I've invested in before and I'm willing to bet on the horse, or maybe I haven't invested before, but that's the case I'm talking about. Those are the two cases. But realistically, even in those cases, I would push the founder of like, hey, could you just show me that you're able to connect supply and demand, whether it's through like text message or Excel spreadsheet or Airtable? Like you should just be able to do this in a very low cost way. Like the beauty of your product, ShareTribe, right, is that it's made it so accessible to do these things and so low cost. Like you should just be able to do this like off of most people's budget. And that's my like thing is like marketplaces, you don't take product risk on. Like it's largely commoditized, like the product experience for marketplaces. And so you don't need to raise $1 million to build a product, right? In fact, like most of the time what I recommend to people is a product like yours, like, hey, just go put it up and fast do it and see if you can get traction.
Yeah.
Because if you can't, then what's the point, right? Like you having $1 million on a product isn't probably going to make the experience on most, you know, most of the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then indeed, like if the other conditions you set out are met, then whether ShareTribe or, you know, you're faking it with an Excel sheet, like those connections should happen like pretty much, like it doesn't need any super unique user experience. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I like the, there was recently some really cool comparative like article about the jockey, what is it, like the horse or the rider, and that the answer was yes because it's like equally important. Like that turned out that, you know, like some funds have really strong thesis on like we're founder first and we believe in founder and others in the fund, and that generally I think like some really long time period analysis showed that they perform equally well. So you mentioned, you know, your business model specific, but I feel that like the business model, you already referred to it a little bit, like, you know, marketplace 1.0, I think you said the first generation. It's not a static business model, I feel like, or there's at least sort of like variations. Like, Have you seen any cool ones like recently that you're like, oh, this is a, you already mentioned some sort of like progression of this, but where do you think we're currently at or what's coming next in that tense?
Yeah, I just wrote a post on this, and we can put it in the show notes on AI and marketplaces. And for me, like, I think the next like really interesting kind of innovation is going to be what I call agent-led marketplaces. Ultimately, like one of the best parts about AI is that it's really good at aggregating and synthesizing lots of information and making recommendations, which seems to fit, in my mind, really well with matching in marketplaces. You know what? And also, what is it great at? It's really good at making and like taking lots of data and refining it and make it better. And so, like, what's that great for? Supply, enrichment, profiles, you know, like all that kind of stuff. And I imagine for you guys, you know, there's ultimately some cool product innovations that can come from that. I just think that there's this world in which agent, you know, led marketplaces are kind of the next phase. And you're already starting to see it. Most of them are in the labor marketplace space because I think that's actually the lowest friction area to start. It's I've seen a lot of them pop up with matching supply and demand in labor markets because the data there is like pretty like legible in terms of like what's their profile, what's their experience, where are they located? You know, like a lot of like, it's basically a lot of criteria matching that's like easier, but I've seen it less in physical products for sure. But I think that's the next big area that I'm watching for and investing in. And I'm also really intrigued by the idea that agents become the supply in certain markets. Take me, for example. You know, like you want to interact with me and pay for my time, like say on Intro.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I'm great. I want to book Colin for half an hour. It costs X amount of dollars.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that I have to be available on some time frame that's reasonable for you still want to do this and on a time frame that you are available. Like, you know, even us getting this podcast, you're in a different time zone. You know, it takes coordination costs to get that. Realistically, what you're going to do is you're going to ask me a series of questions. Call them. Tell me about like how to build a marketplace. Tell me what's important for me. Well, all of these things, I'll probably give the same answer to every person, you know, roughly. Well, what if I just trained a bot or an agent to have all my answers for me and you could interact with that at any time, right? And like, yeah, I get that the perceived value may be lower. Like I'm not talking to a human, but I'd also probably appreciate being able to do it at 3 a.m. when I have a question and not waiting 3 days to talk to Colin when he's available and paying a lot of money because you're paying for my time because it's discrete. And so I think there's this world in which knowledge is actually really well dispensed from AI and that we may be able to see a rise of labor marketplaces that are really just agents, you know, and getting access in real time to people's mind and information. And they get better over time as you feed them more and more questions or responses.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then sort of at the seed, because I'm just trying to think, you know, like this sounds like that there's a risk of commoditization, but of course, like at the seed of each sort of these agents is a unique supply point, like whether that is a mind like yourselves, for example.
No, it's just like your data like is the unique supply, like my, like, or not, like the information that I hold within my brain and that I choose to articulate in a certain way is unique to me and isn't necessarily commodity, right? I mean, people argue maybe once you put information out, it becomes commodity. But I think the nuance of context is the hard part. And so like, if you could train something to be really, you know, very similar to me, use my voice even, which is totally doable, 11 Labs, Descript, they both do this already. You can start to see like where, oh man, we could have digital Colin giving you answers.
Yeah, no, that's actually really cool because I read about agents and like it sounded just like a, you know, like a new word for chatbot, to be honest, in some cases. And I was like, oh, it's just, but actually now when you mentioned this, like my mind goes back to the Marketplace conference where I was in September in Berlin. And there was a company there called Exactly.ai. I'm just going to drop them here. I don't even know, do they still exist? But they were an AI for artists. So they actually said like, hey, you know, like, there's so much, you know, what's it called, plagiarism going on or people ripping off your art or you won't have time to do your art or people want your art, but they don't want to pay the full price for it. How about like they have some platform where artists can train their like an AI on their art and then customers can just ask, hey, like, you know, they choose a style or they choose an artist and say, hey, draw me this, like, and just use the, you know, like the same sort of interface as many of the AI image creators have that like, hey, draw me an image in the style of this. And it was really cool. I tried it out. It was like, you know, some of the drawings make absolutely no sense, like, you know, because AI, you know, the weird thing, but yeah. Nevertheless, they get the style like very right. Like for certain use, not for unique artworks, but for certain use for, you know, if whatever corporation wants to generate some background in the style of this particular unique artist, then like, this is the way. That's cool. Now I know how to classify it because I wasn't sure like what to do with that. But yeah, okay, that's very cool. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Where did you want to add something still? Or
yeah, I think just building on that nugget that you had there, that like there's some preference or taste or, you know, intangible quality that can almost flavor the AI to give it something unique, which I think is important. But you can also start to see how that might really bleed over away from labor into actually like product design or, you know, the building of any given thing based on knowledge or preference of a certain person.
Yeah.
Right. So like, I think that's like, or a set of people or anything. Right. And so I think that's where like you can start to get these really interesting applications of like, I'm paying for access to an agent that is specifically trained for this use case that's really valuable.
Yeah.
Right. And it only gets better and better over time the more it gets used.
Yeah.
And I think that's the surface area that I'm really interested in. Like, you know, overall, I think marketplaces, you know, people keep asking me what's next.
Yeah.
I think what we don't know is that AI and just the evolution of the world in general and technology is going to open new surface areas for marketplaces that we just haven't thought of.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, you know, people are like, oh, marketplaces are dead or whatever.
Yeah.
They say. And it's like, well, of course they're not dead. Like, how do you think capitalism works? People like supply and demand get matched over time repeatedly. Yeah. And that's how, like, that's how capitalism works. So it's just, and where value gets captured is different over time. And so I'm really intrigued by trying to think more about what's the new surface area for marketplaces rather than trying, you know, trying to think about like specific applications, like where, you know, I'm trying to think where are like there are new needs, like new demand sets popping up. Let me give you a really quick example and then move on to new questions. Cloudflare just launched, or not just, but it was like a couple months ago, launched a marketplace where basically bots can pay to get access to websites, right? And the whole point is like bots want data, right? Websites have the data. Of course, this makes sense. Like, you know, like we now have a world in which, yes, you can charge for people to access your unique data on your website. And, you know, you can already see this with the robots.txt, right? Like the whole idea of it was like, hey, I can block certain bots and things and pages from getting crawled from Google. They're benevolent in theory. And so they'll listen to what your robots.txt says. But Cloudflare basically says, hey, we don't need that. We can just be trustless here and just block everything. And then the things that do want access, you know, you can either tell us what they are, or you can require that people pay to get access. And I think that's like a new paradigm that I just really haven't thought of, you know, like even me, like I'm like, that's a brilliant conceptual surface area that has many different applications. And now I'm excited to think about that. Is these prediction markets. These are the whole new type of marketplaces. Like Kalshi, basically all these prediction markets, you know, that they were big in the United States during the election was like, is Trump or Harris going to win? Those are like a totally new type of marketplace, right? Where you can bet essentially on outcomes. There's, you know, a bunch of like demand for essentially people wanting to know the probability of an outcome. And so they supply a market to figure out that probability.
Okay. That is interesting. Yeah. I do always like that when, for example, you know, that in many of these cases that like the bookies are always right, because like some wisdom of the masses still seems to overrule some of the most advanced data analytics. But yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That's great, because I had this question lined up, of course, like at the end, like what's the future of marketplace? But you nicely answered already a little bit into that. Then I actually have one more question, which I don't usually do at the end. Because of your experience, you know, you've built marketplaces or you build marketplaces to scale. You talk to so many founders, like the key of this podcast is to sort of advise and inspire, you know, aspiring or maybe people super early stage into their journey and help them build a successful marketplace. Like what are some tips that you would have for them? Like what do you see that people, for example, do really well? Like, hey, people should really still figure, or do maybe not so well? Like do you have a few that you can always give away to founders?
I think I hit on a few of them earlier, but I think two big hallmarks of very successful marketplaces is one, they do aggregate some very like unique supply, right? Like this, like I think thinking hard about whether what you have is really desirable and can't be found anywhere else is really important. That's something I talk to founders about a lot, is like, it's really what you have. Like if you're in your heart of hearts, is it truly unique and valuable? And if the answer is no, it doesn't mean you can't be successful. It just means like, it's going to make it harder for you to like be breakout, right? And to have like real kind of cornering of a resource, if that makes sense. Next thing that I think is equally important, and honestly can override even kind of supply uniqueness, is that demand aggregation at scale and some distribution strategy from day one that is well thought out and intelligent. I think you just don't want to stumble into your strategy, right? Like, you want to be like really considerate about and understand the demand side of your market, of like how you're going to go get it. And then I'll give you a quick example. Like, for Outdoorsy, we knew that people were searching in Google for RV rentals. We just built the whole business around search, which is pretty obvious, right? But to be an expert at search is not a given, right? Like, being good at SEO is not a given. And so, you know, I give them to the founders. They did a great job of like going out and hiring people that were experts in those things, because that was going to be their strategy. That was going to be their go-to-market. I think that's really important. And I see a lot of founders that don't have a good line of sight on their go-to-market. And so I think that's where I would like to, I usually ask people to try to sharpen a knife a little bit more before, you know, they like go raise money, is like, have you figured out like what your, almost your competitive advantage is when it comes to go-to-market? Like, what is it? Can you articulate it such that people will go, oh, that's smart, they're experts, or they are way ahead of everybody, like they're doing it differently. Like, you got to make it underwritable, right, for investors. In the same token, like, underwritable investors also means, can you yourself want to put more money into this, or other people, such that, you know, it has, because it has a good flywheel. Those are the two things that I think about a lot as like hallmarks for success for marketplaces, even outside of like the context of raising venture capital or not.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, they say, I don't know who said this, but like, I once saw this, maybe it was a tweet or something, that like, someone said like, okay, first time founder is about the product, like second time founder is about the distribution, because there's like coming up with the ideas, like it, as hard as it is, and executing it is really great. But then if you don't have a great avenue of actually getting this out there, it's like, that could absolutely like kill a really great business deal. All right, cool. Yeah, it's one more thing about distribution actually got me thinking. You also have another business called longtailgrowth.com, which is about basically SEO for marketplaces, programmatic SEO for marketplaces. And like I said in the beginning, you have several things going on. So maybe a nice way to close is to tell us, how can people reach out to you? How can they find more about Yonder, Longtail, or Colin?
You said Longtail is programmatic SEO stack for marketplaces and platforms. Like, I took what I learned through the last 15 years of building marketplaces based on search, and just got super frustrated that there wasn't something out there, and wanted to provide it to founders. So if you want to learn more about that, and that's at longtailgrowth.com. But for majority of everything else I do for writing and on my Substack, it's GardnerColin.com. I'm sure if you just search my name, I'll pop up. And then for the fund, if you're interested in, you know, applying to the fund for fundraising, it's just yonder.vc, Colin at yonder.vc. Feel free to come in and share what you're building. I'd love to hear. And then I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter, and love to hear from you. So those are all spots.
Yeah, I can attest to you. Colin is very generous with his time and knowledge, so do reach out. Dan, Colin, thanks a lot for your time, and we'll be in touch.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Two-Sided, the Marketplace podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you really liked it, please give us a rating or a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you got inspired to build your own marketplace, go visit www.sharetribe.com. It's the fastest way to build a successful online marketplace business.